Okay, so in this lecture, I would like to get into more depth about something that seems very simple, but as you work on it, you find it that it's more and more complex and deep and surprising, which is the notion of the pointing and navigation in user interfaces. It looks simple because you spend your life pointing, and there doesn't seem to be much to it, right? You move the cursor to the target, you click, and that's it. It's an area where I've worked on, so that's also why I'm talking about it, of course. And I have been lucky enough to work with Yves Guillard, who's a French psychologist, who has discovered HCI. Now it's probably been about 15 years ago, but was trained and worked for a long time as a real psychologist specializing in the study of human movement, and in particular what's called reaching tasks or pointing. And so I've borrowed some of his material for the part that talks about Fitt's Law in particular. So I'm going to introduce pointing, then we're going to talk about Fitt's Law again, then we'll talk about beating Fitt's Law. Can we use computers to make us point faster? Then we'll talk about multi-scale pointing, which is a generalization of navigation. And then I'll talk about other laws of movement to show you that, you know, even though we haven't solved pointing, there are still other things that can use the same approach. So, as I said, most of the things you do in a GUI is to point with a pointing device, whether it's a mouse, the trackpad on your laptop, or the touch screen or on your smartphone. And the other common task is entering text. And there is a whole lot of work in HCI about entering text. How fast can you type? And if you don't have a keyboard, a regular keyboard, how can you enter text efficiently? Which, of course, nowadays with small devices that you have in your hand, things like phones that only have 12-key keyboards is a critical thing. So I could have done a whole other class in entering text. So when we talk about pointing, what we find is that if you look at a screen, you have many, many possible, what we call targets, things you may want to point at. So some can be very small. So for example, if I have the word small, and I want to put the cursor in between the two L's, here it's big text, but when I was editing the slides, it's small, and if you are typing text, it's even smaller. So some targets are very small, and because screens are becoming larger, there are more and more targets to choose from. And since pointing is really the most frequent thing we do on a computer, pointing performance is an important thing. If I could save 10% of the time each time I point, well, I would save probably, you know, an hour a day. The problem is that pointing performance, as we will find out, is not really limited by the computer. It's unfortunately limited by our human capabilities. And indeed, computers are getting faster and faster, and we don't point faster and faster. So there is a difference, however, in pointing in the real world and pointing on a computer, is that the real world doesn't know anything about you or where you may want to point. The computer maybe has some more information. Well, for one thing, it knows what are the pointable things. It knows the targets. It created them for you. So it knows the targets. So is there a way that we can use this information that the computer has that the real world doesn't have to help us humans point more efficiently? And when I say more efficiently, it's not just about pointing faster. it's also pointing with fewer errors. And performance in these types of tasks is always interpreted as combining speed, doing things as fast as possible, and accuracy, minimizing the number of errors. This is especially important because in many interfaces, if you make an error when pointing, if you point next to the target instead of on the target, well, in some cases, it's a dead click, nothing happens, and you just try again. But in many cases, a wrong click will cause an unwanted action. So something that happens often to me is when I want to close a window, I go for the close button, and then I miss, and I click on the window behind it, and so the window behind it comes on top, and now I have to first, find the other window I was in, bring it back on top. It may be that window is now completely occluded by the window I have popped on, so I have to move that window, make the other back in front, close it, and then move the back window again. And so an error can have a very high cost. No, there can be things even worse if I click, the delete button instead of the other button and things like this. So the cost of error can be high. So as I've already talked about, and I will talk about again, the similar work on pointing was conducted by Paul Fitts in the 1950s. Before computers were in existence, but they were not used for interactive tasks. And he was studying the speed-precision trade-off in directed movements. That's more or less the title of the paper. So we see here this notion of speed-precision trade-off. I can point very fast, but I'm not precise. I am not accurate. If I want accuracy, I'm going to have to go slower. So how can I optimize this trade-off? His initial hypothesis was that the movement time, MT, would be a linear function of the index of difficulty. And initially, he described the index of difficulty as being the base 2 logarithm of 2 times the distance divided by W. That was partly inspired by information theory, and I talked about that in the previous lecture on theories and models. If you look at Shannon's theory, you have this notion of the ratio between signal and noise. So here, the signal is the distance that you're trying to cover. You're trying to get from one target to another. Ideally, they are distance d apart, and you have to cover exactly this distance. But the width of the target operationalizes the notion of precision. If I tolerate that you do this with 10 centimeters precision, I put a target that is 10 centimeters wide around the destination. So you understand that here the notion of target and target size was created to operationalize what he was studying, the speed-precision trade-off. In our computers, target size is target size. If you click outside, you're not clicking on the target. So here, he was more interested, in a sense, in allowing people to be imprecise than really to distinguish if you click inside or outside the target. And so the underlying, the other underlying assumption here is that our motor system is capable of limited bandwidth that is providing generating information. So if you look in this equation and you take ID divided by MT, ID is expressed in bits of information, movement time in seconds. So ID by MT is in bits per second. And that's what we call throughput. It's the amount of information per second that you can produce. So what we will find is that the throughput of the human motor system for this task is a few bits per second. So we're not, you know, we're not the gigabit network. it's very low throughput. And so that's where the link with information theory comes in, where you see the human motor system as the source for a channel to communicate information. You may wonder why there is a 2 there, 2D over W. Originally, the idea is that the precision is really half of W, not the whole width. So if you do D over W divided by 2, you get 2D over W. But of course, because it's a log, you can take the log 2 out, and it could be something plus log the D over W. So here's the data from Fitt's original paper. As you see, he did 2 studies. In fact, there were 4 studies. Well, there were a study with a pointing task that was illustrated there. There was another one where you had disks that you had to put on rods. And that was another task that combined speed and accuracy. So I'm only talking about the first task here, and he had 2 conditions with 2 stylus of different weight, a very light one and a very heavy one, to see if it made a difference. You see on the left the values for W, so 0.25, 0.5, 1, and 2, and the values for amplitude, which is distance, 2, 4, 8, 16, and then the index of difficulty that you can compute from that, which goes from 4 to 7. Well, we see a lot of numbers here, so here's the not the plot in Fitt's original paper. In fact, there is no plot. So this is from McKenzie, who's a Canadian researcher, who's done a lot of work, still doing a lot of work on Fitt's law, and so he took this data we just saw and plotted it in movement time vertically as a function of index of difficulty. So the different dots, the triangles, are for width 0.25 and 0.5, and the circles are 1 and 2 inches. And then he computed the regression lines. So movement times equals 12.8 milliseconds plus 94.7 times the ID. And so the index of performance, in that case, is 10.6 bits per second. And so in a physical pointing task, essentially, the index of performance is about 10 bits. Now, one thing you see is that, yeah, it's a pretty good linear regression. If you look at the bottom, there are things that are a bit weird. This black dot is really off the line. And at the top, things, well, there's not really enough data to tell, but the top triangle is also above the line. So is that really a line? Well, a number of people have looked at this, and I'll get to it in a second. Before that, I wanted to show another interesting piece of data, which is if you measure the speed during the movement, you get this type of profile. So in fact, what happens is if you point very fast, this velocity profile tends to be a symmetric bell curve. You go as fast as you can until you slow down as fast as you can. As you need to adjust more, you keep the left of the profile, you go as fast as you can, but you slow down earlier so you can have more time to adjust. And so typically, as the task becomes harder, you reach the peak velocity earlier in movement, and then you spend more and more time adjusting. So here, the peak is at about 0.4, and the pointing occurred after 1.2. So you would spend about one-third speeding up, and one-third slowing down to 0.8 to almost a stop, and then adjusting for the last third. This means that if you're trying to predict where you're going to point based on the early profile, you're not going to go very far. A lot of people have tried to improve pointing by saying, well, the system can capture what you're doing. And so, you know, if I know how fast you're going, if I know where this peak is, maybe I can anticipate at least where you're going to go and maybe help you by putting you there faster or something. The problem is that these techniques don't work well because there is not enough information in what's called the ballistic phase of the movement. The ballistic phase is when you are throwing your arm to start a movement before you regain control and slow it down. The study of these profiles has also been important for people who try to understand how does the motor control work on the human side. The dominant theory now is that there is this initial ballistic movement. You throw your arm, then you stop it, and then you have these correction phases, and you have various sub-movements. It's not, doesn't quite show up in this plot, but oftentimes you see the big initial bump and then smaller ones, saying, you know, you adjust progressively. But the thing that is kind of fascinating is that we don't still understand how the human controls that movement. There are various theories, and even though the sub-movements one is the dominant one, it's not really considered the final explanation. So as we saw before, the fit for Fitt's law, you know, it was pretty good with the line, but is it really the best fit? So a number of people have explored alternative functions. So McKenzie in particular created what's called the McKenzie formulation of the law, where the index of difficulty is log of d over w plus 1. And people like that for a number of reasons. Well, first, you cannot have negative values for the log, since it's 1 plus something that is always positive. It's annoying when you get negative pointing time, which could happen with Fitt's formulation. And the other thing is you can also formulate d over w plus 1 as d plus w over w, and some people find that more natural. I don't, but... But then people have tried other versions. So early work by Schmidt predicted just d over w, no log. And Mayer et al. Tested various power versions where you have d over w at fractional power. So for example, here square root. And that gives pretty good fit. The other reason why the McKenzie one is the one you'll see almost everywhere in HCI publications is because it's even more similar to Shannon's information theory, bandwidth formula, which is also 1 plus signal over noise. But the thing that is important here is that whichever function you use, the idea is always a function, a monotonic function of d over w. So really, d over w are the determinant factor of this thing. And that means that Fitt's law can be seen as a scale invariance law. And scale invariance is something that we find in nature in a number of situations. So by scale invariance, it means that if you want to if I double the amplitude of the movement, if d becomes twice as big, and if I double the size of the target, w gets twice as big. So I get from d over w to 2d over 2w, which is the same thing, and therefore pointing time is the same. So in a pointing task, if you double distance and width, or if you half distance and width, or if you multiply by any factor for that matter, pointing time is constant. That's where the invariance comes from, which is something sort of remarkable. Now, there are other laws in psychophysics and psychology that show scale invariance. For example, if you look at birds or insects flapping their wings, you have the same relationship that the variability of the flapping. So if you look at the amplitude of successive flaps, they are not exactly the same. The variability is proportional to the amplitude. It seems pretty intuitive that if you're doing a large movement, you have more variability than if you are a mosquito and you flap your tiny little wing. But that's something that's been observed and is well known in psychology. So it probably means that there are some both mechanical and human controlled processes that are similar. And in fact, the concept of Fisk's law have been used to study many other tasks. Here it was a linear tapping. People have done it with angular movements. People have used it for all sorts of things where you have this trade-off between speed and precision. Now, one thing to say, though, is that Fitt's law is valid only within certain limits, fairly small limits. If you look at the global picture of things. So the absolute amplitude, the maximum distance, has to be fairly small. I mean, it has to be performed with the arm and maybe the upper body. If I put the target on the door there, even if I remove the tables, I'd ask you to point, to run there, point, and then come back to the to the desk here and point and go back to the door, you will not get Fitt's law. And the reason is because as soon as the velocity profile doesn't show a peak, Fitt's law is not going to apply. If you have, and when you run, you reach plateau limit speed, so constant speed, so your velocity profile goes up and then stays flat as you run, and then you slow. And this will not follow Fitt's law. In fact, you will have the distance term being dominant, and your movement time will be proportional to distance, pretty much irrespective of the size of the target. Now, if you look at the width, first of all, the width has to be smaller than the distance to the target, because if you're already in the target, there's no pointing. So that's one side. On the other side, if you have a tiny, tiny, tiny target, you will not be able to reach it reliably. So, you know, under 1/10 of a millimeter, maybe, it is really hard to have precise movements. Now, the precision of the human hand is surprisingly high. But still, you will reach a limit. If I give you a micron, you won't be able to hit it. It will be pure chance. So if you look at index of difficulties that are outside these limits, then you know things go completely wrong. So the ratio of D over W, if you take a maximum amplitude of about a meter and a minimum target width of about half a millimeter, D over W is about 2,000. And so if you take the log formulation of the ID, you get around 11, 12. We conducted an experiment with Yves Guillard on a tablet that had very high precision, and we were able to have 12 bits precision. The only way we were able to do this was by having a display where you would see an enlarged version of what's happening near the target. So the problem there was not your motor control, but your vision. And so if you magnify the area near the target, we were able to point at things that were about a tenth of a millimeter. So this is sort of internal validity of the law. There's external validity as well. There's all these experiments. You'll find literally hundreds of papers that have used Fitts' law to compare input devices, that have used Fitts' law to try to improve pointing. But you won't find anything that has tried to see if people who use computers every day, if their pointing actions really follow Fitts' law. So this is work that we've conducted in our group that hasn't been published yet. And what we did is we created a small program that tracks the movements of your mouse and the places where you click. And we have 24 users who agreed to install it on their machine for several weeks and months. And we collected this data. So from this data, we had about a billion pixels covered by the various mice. So it's as if you were pushing a mouse for 352 kilometers. And we extracted 2 million aimed movements. That is, movements where we knew what the target was. We had to throw away a lot of the data because a lot of times we don't know exactly what is the target because regular applications, you know, don't tell you much about what is a target and what isn't. There are things we know are targets, like, you know, buttons and scroll bars and things like this, but in the middle of your... So if you're editing a Word document, well, every character is possibly a target, but we don't have this information in our data. And so if you do this rough plot that we see on the right, we do the movement time against index of difficulty. And, well, in red is the, well, one way to do the regression, which is in itself a tricky problem for this kind of data. And so you see that, in fact, there is more or less a lower limit. There are dots at the very bottom, which are probably outliers due to problems with our algorithms to classify movements. But you can see that, you know, under this line there's almost nothing. And this line that we didn't plot here would be the line corresponding to an index of index of performance of about 10 bits. So that's sort of the limit of expert performance. If you click really quickly, as we ask you to do when you do a Fitts pointing task, then you get sort of the lower part of things. But in practice, a lot of things take a lot longer. One of the things we found out is people go to the target fairly quickly, but then they pause before clicking. And so we conducted a bunch of analysis where we took this into account, but so, and that's because of the cost of error. And clearly, if you anticipate a higher cost of error, it's not slowing down the pointing itself. It's just slowing down the clicking to say, am I really where I want to be? Yes, I click. Which could probably be modeled by this mental operator that we saw in GOMS. You know, move, I am there, yes. Instead of move, click, and then see what happens. The other thing is that if you aggregate all these moves for a given user over time, you see that there are a number of hotspots on the screen. So this one had three hotspots at the bottom here, where there were icons in the toolbar. And then in the top left, and that's particularly because every time you create a new window, it comes up there, and so people often have to close windows there and get to the menu also at the top left. So when we think of Fitts' law, and you see a lot of papers that say, oh, you know, I've got technique that is, you know, 12 milliseconds faster than everything else. Well, in practice, it's unlikely to make a big difference. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, but if the difference is reliable but small, as I explained in the class on experimental design, it has little value. So the question then for people working at CI is, can we beat Fitt's law? Can we find a way to point where we are not limited by this linear relationship? Or can we simply make lower the regression line, which means increase the index of performance? Well, first of all, the first thing that people realize is that when you point with a mouse, with a joystick, with a touch screen, it tends to be slower than when you point in Fitt's condition on the table directly with your arm on the desk. So then there's two ideas there. One is, can we use the computer to help us point faster? And as I said before, can we use the information that computer has about what targets are on the screen to help? Another research question is, we saw that Fitt's had limited, had limits of validity. And can we beat those limits? So we'll see a number of approaches that have tried to do that. And if I have time, I'll show a couple of videos, and I'll put the links on the wiki in any case. Okay, so all of the work, except for one instance, have taken for granted that this trade-off between distance, amplitude and precision is there, and we're stuck with it. So they're not trying to create pointing techniques where it would be a different law than Fitt's law that would apply. They're not trying to change the law. They're trying to reduce the A and the B. So the A is the origin, and the B is the more important factor. It's the slope of the curve, of the line. So if I reduce the slope, if I make B lower, which means that the index of performance, which is 1 over B, gets higher, you get more bits per second, then I can get a better technique. So, first idea, let's try to reduce the ID. Again, the computer knows where the targets are. The computer knows what I am doing. It knows, it can track my mouse. Well, not always, because if I'm on a touch-sensitive surface, usually these systems don't track the motion when you are in the air. It only tracks when you hit the surface. But let's assume we're in a mouse-based environment or trackpad-based environment, so the system is tracking the cursor and the input device. So first idea is to reduce the ID. And to reduce the ID, we have to artificially decrease the distance and or increase width. So one technique here is Drag and Pop by Patrick Bodish, who was at Microsoft at the time. He says, well, in a dragging task, I take a target, I take a source icon, and I move it towards a destination icon, which can be the trash can, which can be an application, which can be a folder. So if I track the initial movement, I can infer the direction. And then I can go into that direction and see what potential targets are possible destinations for that particular icon. So if I'm dragging a Word document, I can put it into the trash can, the recycle bin. I can put it into Explorer. I can put it into Word. But it doesn't make sense to put it into PowerPoint or Illustrator or Outlook. So what happens with Drag and Pop is you start moving towards where you want to go, and the potential targets come to you with this display here that shows sort of this elastic, which means that they're much more closer. And so you have reduced distance quite significantly. So Dragon Pop was shown to work. There are issues when you have many potential targets that will come to you, and so they, in the default situation here where there are a few targets, you see that they keep their layout. If you have many of them, then they get into a grid, and so it takes time to track the target you're aiming for, and so with many targets, this technique doesn't really bring much advantage. It also only works for situations where you are doing a drag operation and you know what are the potential targets. If you were doing this in regular pointing, where as soon as you move your mouse, all targets come to the cursor, it would just not work. So it is a nice technique, but it is applicable only to a few number of cases. Now, another idea that is quite interesting was implemented by Shumin Zai, and it's called magic pointing. And here the idea is that we're going to extract even more information from you, the user, by looking at your gaze, the direction of where you look. And that's based on studies that have shown that when I'm trying to acquire a target, I'm going to look at the target before my hand gets there. So if I can track your gaze, know where you're looking, then maybe I can accelerate the pointer or even teleport the pointer in that direction. So that's what they did in Magic. It looked very promising, but the results were not really that magic. So yes, you have a little advantage, but not as much as you would expect. And part of it is because, you know, we are used to the laws of physics and the way our body works. And so every time you try to get things faster for the user, it requires adaptation from the user to adapt to this. And this notion of having your cursor jump to where you're looking, you still have to adapt to it. And it's the kind of things where it's very hard to get it right. You don't want the cursor to constantly move where you look, because I may have the cursor somewhere in my screen doing something and I need to look at something else to gather information and I want to get back where I was. If the cursor follows my gaze, it's going to be distracting and I will lose time in other tasks. So I think it's a great idea. Maybe it can be made to work better, but the results were, in my opinion, disappointing. Okay, so this was about decreasing distance. Now, what about increasing width? So that's the work that was conducted by McGuffin and colleagues. And the idea here is that as your cursor approaches a target, let's have the target get bigger. And what they showed is that the performance, meaning especially pointing time, was predicted by the ID for the expanded target size, not the original size. Now, we conducted a follow-up experiment because in this case, the users knew that the targets were growing. So could they be taking this into account? Which is not a problem in itself. I mean, it's fine if you have this sort of feedback loop that if you know the target is going to get bigger, you take this into account into your gesture. But the thing we found, we conducted the exact same experiment, except in half the cases, the target would not get bigger, in the other half, it would get bigger, and users didn't know, so they couldn't anticipate. And we found the exact same results, is that it is, even though the target expands when you're pretty close to it, you will take it into account immediately, sort of, as you're performing your movement. And the reason is, in fact, in the velocity profile I showed before, is that you spend little time to get close to the target, and then a lot of time to adjust at the end. So if the target changes, you can adapt to it. And in fact, recently we did another piece of work on moving targets, because that's something you start seeing in many interfaces, where you know, in on the Mac, I have Exposé, where I can do things like this, where the windows animate, and I can start moving things while the windows move, and so am I able to anticipate the position of the target, and or is this going to slow me down? And it's remarkable how we are able to adapt to moving target or targets that change size. Now, the problem, of course, is that if you enlarge targets, and there are lots of targets next to each other, if they start overlapping, then you're not increasing their size. So they took the example here of something like the dock and the Macintosh, where you expand the targets. And to make room, the expanding target pushes the other ones around. But as I think I've shown in the very first class, what happens is the effective target width doesn't change. In fact, on the dock here, and I can show it to you, you see that if I move the cursor up and down, the icon moves the other direction. So if I count the number of pixels where my cursor is inside this target, it's the exact same number of pixels as it uses when it's not expanded. And you can do the math, and there is no, I mean, you cannot invent pixels, right? You have n pixels, you have p targets, you can only assign n over p pixels per target. You can play whichever game you want, it's not going to work better. Now, there may be advantages to expansion because your movement is not, in fact, just horizontal. You also come from above and other things. But in practice, there is little advantage to this type of expansion. And what we find, what we start seeing, is that all these techniques, they can improve pointing in some circumstances, but then they degrade it in others. So it then becomes a question of how often, you know, are you in one case versus the other. So next, increase maximal speed. Now that's another interesting idea, is that if I want you to use less time, you're going to have to go faster. So, I mentioned before the control display ratio, which is how relative movements of the mouse on the horizontal axis are mapped to relative motion of the cursor. The idea being, if I move slowly, I have small incremental movements, so I'm at the left of the curve here, so I have small motions of the cursor. This gives me precision. If I move fast, each incremental movement is larger, so I'm towards the right of the curve, and then I have much proportionally bigger control of the cursor. That's what's called mouse acceleration in your control panels, and you can adjust it. So what it does really is it distorts the space. And it means that the space of the mouse, your trackpad, is a different geometry than the space of your screen, the visual space. What is remarkable is that humans adapt to this very quickly. Most people, if you don't tell them there is max acceleration or what it is, they don't realize there is anything wrong. But if you set it to very low, they will find, oh, this mouse is slow. It's not the mouse that's slow, it's the response of the cursor. So one of my former students, Renaud Blanc, who's in fact a SuperEC student, did this technique called semantic pointing. And the idea is that rather than enlarging the targets in visual space on the screen, we're going to enlarge them in motor space on your mouse trackpad, if you wish. Now, it's hard to imagine what this means. What this means is that rather than having a fixed response curve, as we saw before, for mass acceleration, we adapt the gain to the proximity of a target. So if you are in what we call empty space, when there is no target, your mass can go very fast, so we set a high gain. As you approach the target, we lower the gain. Now, I have a little app here. I'll put the link to it on the website. It's easy to find. It's on Renaud Blanc's website. So here's the situation. On the left is the visual space. It's what you see on your screen. On the right is, in gray, is your trackpad, what the mouse sees, if you wish. Now, this is a standard situation where I have no semantic pointing, so I can point this corner of the window, enlarge it, I can move the window, and nothing interesting happens. Now, I enable semantic pointing with the S, and when I'm in empty space, still nothing happens. But look to the right, when I approach the corner here, for the mouse, this resize box becomes much bigger. Now, of course, I don't see what's happening to the right. It would be distracting. What I see is what's happening to the left. So if you look to the left, you don't see much happening. But I can tell you, and you can test it at the break, that it looks like my mouse is sticky when it gets close to the target, which makes it easier to acquire. And the same thing happens with the title bar. We enlarge it less for the title bar. We enlarge it more for the close window, which closes the window. And we have a similar thing with the icons here. Oops, right. That was a click outside. And at the bottom with the slider, you can see how the scale is dynamically adjusted to the vicinity of the target. So this can apply to windows, as we saw. We can apply it to dialog boxes, make the default button much bigger. And also, we can make targets harder to reach. Like the dangerous don't save could be made smaller, which will make your mouse slippery. So it'll be harder to get. Now, we can be really nasty and make it zero size in motor space and impossible to catch, which I thought was something terrible because, you know, there's pages on the web where you have to click if you don't want to receive their spam and all that. With this technique, you could show it as a big dialog box or checkbox and make it impossible to reach. So we can also apply it to things like scroll bars, so they use less space but are still as easy to grab as they are currently. What we showed is that, indeed, the index of difficulty for the task is determined by the size in motor space, not the size in visual space, which is a remarkable result. Now, Yves Guillard, who was also working on this project with us, pushed this to the limit and said, well, why just go fast in empty space? Why not just skip it? And that, what he's calling object pointing, where you skip empty space. So I'm in the target, and as soon as I move, I look at the direction of motion, and I jump the cursor to the nearest target in that direction. So we did an experiment with the Fitz situation, and we showed that pointing time was constant, indeed. It was very easy because there is one target in the Fitz law, so as soon as you leave the target on the left, poof, you're in one on the right, you click, and you go back. But it's nice. We have beaten Fitz law effectively. We can point in constant time. The problem is, as with the other techniques, when you have many targets, the prediction, you know, is not always getting you to the target you want to get to. And if you get to the wrong target, then you have to jump again to the next target, and you end up really losing a lot of time. And so we showed that, you know, there was in a typical desktop, there was no gain with object pointing.
But the semantic pointing.
Yes.
Is there a gain? Is it working?
Yes. Yes, because you it's as if the target was the size, the big size you see that you don't see, in fact, that is in motor space. But it doesn't take up more space on the screen. Now, there is the same type of limitation as we saw with the dock. If I have many targets close to each other and they all have a bigger motor size in motor space, I don't get a gain because when things are tiled next to each other, I cannot take advantage of the empty space. And this, in fact, triggered what is currently known or thought to be the best technique, which is the bubble cursor. I think those of you who did the TD saw it. And the bubble cursor is saying, well, let's get rid of empty space, but in a different way. So if you look to the right, let's expand each target to its maximal space, to the maximal space available for it. Now, this is something that is well known in computational geometry. It's called the Voronoi decomposition. So have you heard of that? No? Voronoi, don't know how. Okay, so here it goes. These are the targets, the green dots are the targets here. The first thing you do is for each target, you look at the closest ones. And you can create a graph by linking those targets together, right? And then what you take is the middle of each of these arcs that you've created, edges. So you take the it's called the median, not sure, médiatrice in French. So the orthogonal line to the middle of these, and then you get this decomposition. So that means that each target is exactly in one of these areas, and you can show that each of these areas is maximal. When you are in one of these areas, the closest target is the one in this area. So what the bubble cursor is doing is what you see on the left, is as I move the cursor, the little cross, well, in the original design they had this big gray circle, the bubble, it increases to include the closest target. And so you didn't have to move the cursor inside that target, you could just click as soon as the cursor, the area cursor, the round, the gray circle included the targets. And so what we have at the top, sorry, I made a mistake, what we have at the top is what's called an area cursor. And this has been tried before. Rather than the cursor being just one point, the tip of the arrow or the cross, you make it a square or a circle. The problem is, as you see on the left, is that if you have two targets inside the area cursor, you still have to go in one of them to point. What the bubble cursor does below is it grows until it includes the nearest target and only that nearest target. So effectively, everything happens as if you were navigating in the space where the Voronoi decomposition is visible here. And wherever you are in the space, the target you would reach when you click would be the one in that area. And so it intuitively looks like it has to be the most efficient technique, right? Because every point on the screen is matched to a target and is matched to the nearest target. And so they conducted various experiments and they showed that indeed it was faster than any other methods that have been tried so far. There is a problem, however, that with this technique, you can only click at targets. And in real interfaces, there are many cases where in the empty space, you can still click and you will designate that pixel. For example, when you are selecting icons through a rectangle. So if I go here in my desktop, I can click. All the icons are targets, but if I click outside the target, I start dragging a rectangle to select those objects. So with Bubble Cursor, I couldn't do that because everywhere I click, it would snap to the nearest target. So that led to DynaSpot by Olivier Chapuis from our group here, and he was not alone on this work, where you have the Bubble Cursor. When you move at beyond a certain speed. But if you stop and pause, then you will designate the regular... we will use the regular cursor as before. And so because of this trade-off, you can both take advantage of Bubble Cursor when you move, and you can also click individual pixels. And I think that's one of the techniques that those of you who are in the TD are supposed to work with. Okay, I'm going over time, but... So, are we done yet? The answer is no. I think we've understood a number of things. But there's still no technique that is always winning. We've seen two categories of approaches, target agnostic techniques, are targets that do not know where the targets are. So they try to improve pointing through things like tracking the gaze, for example. That was target agnostic. It didn't use knowledge of what targets are. Target-aware techniques, they need to know what the potential targets are. And these techniques have been shown to be more efficient. And that's not surprising because they use more information. The problem is that in real interfaces, it's often difficult to know exactly what the targets are. Also, it's also difficult to know how important the targets are. So some people have worked on collecting data as you use your interface to see where you click more often. And so, for example, it would make sense to use semantic pointing where targets get bigger in the motor space over time as you use them more and more.
Like a search bar?
Yeah. And so a number of people are using this type of probabilistic approaches to learn targets and to learn users' habits. And you see the trend. The trend is to use more and more information from the user to improve pointing. Because we are fundamentally limited in our ability to control our pointing gestures. So it will always have to get back to reducing the ID in some artificial way, and the only way we know is by using information that is in the system and using information that is in the user. So things like frequency of use, for example, is a simple approach. The second part of this was on navigation. And here, what we were looking at is not breaking Fitts' law in terms of pointing faster in regular situations, but breaking the limits of Fitts' law. So we saw that the limits were about 12 bits for a distance of 1 meter and a size of, say, at least half a millimeter. Now, in the real world, physical world, I have little way to change those limits. For amplitude, I could use, for example, a stick. So I could point with, a stick, which would increase my amplitude, maybe it would reduce precision, probably. In fact, we've done studies where we point with a laser pointer. So if I direct a laser pointer at the screen, well, I lose a lot of precision because the hand is never really stable and every little movement is amplified by the distance to the screen. So to beat the distance limit in the physical world, you will probably lose on precision. And on the other hand, to be able to point at smaller targets, well, you could use a magnifying glass to see better what you're pointing, but there will still be a limit, again, of your on your motor control. Now, in the computer world, there's things you cannot do in the real world, and that thing is zooming. I'm sure you all use Google Maps or Google Earth or any one of these. And, you know, on Google Maps, I can start with my map here on Orsay, and I can zoom out, and I can go to San Francisco and then zoom in and see the house where I live in San Francisco. And what I've done there is a pointing task. The distance is, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 kilometers. The width of the target, well, if I try to look at my house, it's about 10 meters. So you get an index of difficulty that is, I don't know, probably around 20, 25. So when you do these types of tasks, you are doing a pointing task. You're performing it in a very different way. It's not just reaching the target. It's zooming out. When you're moving, we call this panning, like a panoramic panning. So you do panning and zooming. Well, how does this relate to this basic model of pointing that is Fitt's law? Well, to better understand what's going on in these zoomable worlds, a useful tool is called the space scale diagram. It's created originally by Furness and Peterson, George Furness and Ben Peterson. And the idea there is that you have a 2D document like a map, but to represent scale, you use a third dimension, a vertical dimension of scale. And so you have to imagine that your map is completely collapsed into one point at the origin. At scale one, well, you have the real world, if it were a map. And so everywhere in between, you can see the whole world if you take a geographical map at any scale. So does this make sense? You know, if I take a slice of this diagram at a given scale on the vertical axis, I get the same image, but bigger or smaller, depending on where I am. So when I zoom out, do I go up or down on the scale?
No.
Down, because zoom out means I see more, so I get towards the origin where everything is collapsed. And therefore, zooming it is going up. So when I'm looking at this map through a zoomable interface, I have a viewing window, right? So what I'm doing is this viewing window is staying the same size as I move it up and down. And so you see on the right that if I'm at position C at the bottom, I can see all the drawing. If I go up at position D, I move to the right as well, I see only part. And if I go up at position B, then I only see part of the diagram. So what's interesting with this space scale diagrams is that moving and zooming, panning and zooming, can be modeled in that space scale diagram as vertical movements for zooming and horizontal ones for panning. So I have a 3D world where I can look at these movements. So the movements I just described, you know, when I'm going from a map that is centered on Orsay and I'm going to San Francisco, is first I zoom out so I can see the overall area of the target. Then I do so zooming out means I go down until I see as much of the map as I need. Then I see San Francisco there on the left, so I'm going to do panning. So San Francisco is now in the center. And then I can start zooming in. But of course, as I zoom in, meaning I'm going up here in the diagram, the thing I'm looking for is going to get, you know, quickly out of the map if I don't pay attention. So the zoom out can be very fast, but the zoom in has to be constantly adjusted with panning motion to stay on target, literally. So my point here is that the type of motion you're doing is really very different from a regular pointing. But together with Yves Guillard, we've conducted an experiment with this type of interface and with index of difficulty up to 30. Now 30, that means there is a ratio of 2 to the power of 30 between distance and width. So this was Yves Guillard's metaphor was you are, you know, in the Jardin du Luxembourg and you're going to pick a particular flower in Auckland, New Zealand, in another garden there. So, you know, half the around the earth is about 20,000 kilometers, and to pick a flower, it's a centimeter or two, and that gives you the idea of what this index of difficulty is. Another interesting value is that if you look at all the documents in the Library of Congress, if I want, in the US, which is the biggest library in the world, if you want to pick one page of one book in that library, it is also about this size. And what we found is, amazingly enough, Fitts' law holds incredibly well for this index of difficulty and for this zooming task. So what you see at the very left is regular pointing for index up to around 5-6. Then starting around 10, you need some zooming, and you see that the regression is extremely reliable. So that was quite an interesting finding. And then what we looked at is say, well, you know, when you're zooming, there is this notion that when you zoom in, you have to pan. So obviously the size of the view, the size of your window is going to affect your performance. If I'm doing this full screen, which we were doing in the experiment, you know, I have more room for error than if I'm doing this on my smartphone or maybe even on a watch. So we looked at the effect of the view, of the size of the view on this. And the first experiment we conducted, we were very surprised because we had window sizes of 50, 7,500, 200, 350, and 700, as you see at the top here. And there was an effect only for the very smallest one. All of the other ones, they were pretty much aligned. So we conducted a second experiment where we had very small view sizes. This is 10 pixel wide, 20 pixel wide, 40 pixel wide. And in our experiment, we only saw the effect of the view, meaning that the bandwidth, that the slope of the curve gets really bad here, for very, very small sizes, essentially under 20 pixels. It means that in our task, you could do it almost as well with the 20 pixels window than with the full screen. And in fact, we showed on this lower part of the diagram, we show a strong relationship that the movement time was proportional to ID divided by view size. Another way to look at this is that well, there's another invariant there. But the point I want to make is that, of course, this is up to a certain threshold for V. So once V is big enough, then, you know, you're not going to have this relationship, so the degradation by the view size. Move faster here. So another thing we did was to We'll look at how to have zoomable interfaces for things other than maps. I think you may have seen OrthoZoom in the TD as well. So we looked at linear documents, very long documents. So we took a very long document. This was done by Caroline Appert, who was my student, and Jean-Daniel Fekett. Well, she was my student at the time. She is now a researcher and teaching the TD for this class. So the idea was when you scroll a linear document, you can use the other direction of motion to control scale. And so here we have something that shows all the plays of Shakespeare. I think it's about 50,000 lines of text in one single document. And as you move to the next, to the left, the text becomes smaller and smaller. Of course, at some point it becomes unreadable. So what we do is we use the structure of the text, or they use the structure of the text. So you see the titles of the scenes, and then the acts, and then the plays. And then once you are in the play you want, you can zoom in and you can see the acts, and then you can see the scenes, and then you can go to the line. And so this is done by simple vertical motion for panning, horizontal motion for zooming. And we compared this, so they compared this with other techniques. The other best-known technique was called SDAZ, speed-dependent automatic zooming. The idea in SDAZ is, as you scroll, it's using speed. So when you scroll faster, the document automatically zooms out. And as you slow down, it automatically zooms in. It's a very nice technique. But we showed that OrthoZoom was twice as fast as this. And, you know, in general, when you do these types of techniques to improve pointing or navigation, you know, if you get a 10% gain, you are really happy. It's very hard to do better than what's out there. So here, having a gain of a factor of 2 is really rare. And to wrap this up, there are other laws of movement. So, you know, all of this was just about one little thing called Fitts' law. One simple pointing motion in one dimension. The original Fitts' law is just, you know, pointing left and right. So people have looked at other types of movements. Well, first they tried to generalize Fitts' law to 2D pointing. And it looks like, you know, simple problem. Well, very hard problem, in fact. Fairly easy if your targets are circular. But as soon as you look at rectangular targets, you need to take into account the angle at which you get to the target. And what is going to be the width in Fitts' law for that target? Because, in fact, now you have two constraints. First, I need to not miss the target by angle. I don't want to go above or below. But I also need to stop within its width, or depth, or whatever you call it. So, you know, people have proposed different versions of the index of difficulty for these tasks. The one on the right is the most complex, but unfortunately is the one that works the best. And I would say this is not really a solved problem. And it's an important thing, because in the real world, you point in 2D, you point at targets that are often rectangles, but sometimes other shapes. And so if we want to really go deeper into understanding what's going on, we need better models for that. Then Johnny Accot, who's a French researcher, created the steering law. And that came about from studying crossing with Shumin Zai. So crossing is very interesting for interfaces where you use the pen. Because with a pen, you know, tapping targets is fine, but the pen is really designed to draw. And so what they came up with is this notion that instead of clicking a target, you are going to do what's called goal passing or crossing. So the target is this vertical bar, and with your pen, you touch on one side of the bar, you cross over it, and you lift. So it's doing these crossing gestures. And what I found is that if you call W the height of the goal, then Fitts' law applies perfectly to predict performance for goal passing, for crossing tasks. So the interesting thing is that, you know, distance is where you start. So I start here, and I have to cross a goal here. And they tested with vertical goals, horizontal goals, various things. And so it's exactly the same as pointing inside a target that would be this, the same width as the goal is high. And from there, they did something that is that I find really a beautiful piece of work. But they say, well, what if I have to cross two goals? What if I have to, if I had a goal in the middle and I have to cross three goals and four and five? So you do a sort of recursive derivation, and you can, from this crossing law, find the steering law, which is the time it takes to start at one end of this tunnel and move your cursor inside this tunnel without ever going outside. So if the width, if the length of the tunnel is A and its width is W, they found that the time was proportional to A over W. And in fact, this is done by saying, well, you know, a tunnel, that's first approximation, it's one goal at the beginning, one goal at the end. I have to cross these two goals. But I can do anything in between. So to make sure people have to stay in between, I add a third goal in the middle, and I want people to go through this goal. So you take this formula, and you sort of iterate it for as many goals as they are, and you subdivide like this, and when you integrate, you get this. And in fact, they can, using this technique, they can generalize this to a tunnel of any shape and width using this formula here, which is the curvilinear integral of the ds over the local width of the tunnel. And so they tested this with tunnels, spiral tunnels and all that. Now, why are tunnels important? Because there are a number of tasks on computers where you have to drag an object along a certain path. The most well-known one is with submenus. On Windows, I don't know if it has changed, but you had to stay in this item to go into the submenu here. On the Mac, from day one, you could go in diagonal and it would work. But there are other places where you need to have these constrained drags, and so the steering law can model that. So this notion of crossing was used by Appitz and Gambrottière. François Gambrottière is a French researcher who is in the US, and I think he's originally a student from Centrale. And they created this crossing-based interface. So they created a pen-based system where all interaction is done through crossing as opposed to clicking. So for example, and I'll finish with that, you have this toolbar on the right. So if you want to select a pen, you tap on the pen icon, the window to the left shows up, and then without lifting the pen, that's the important point, you cross the goal to select the thickness, which is the first column there. And then you can move down in this area, and here is the goal for green. So instead of having to click, 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 I can do one continuous gesture to select all three through goal passing. So here's an example where there's several options that I can select together. Here the goals are put in a diagonal orientation so that I can cross several of them in one gesture very simply. My favorite is the search and replace function. So you have a find function here where you can find strokes that you've drawn on the surface by thickness and by color. So you can go through this, then you go through the find target here. Then you say, I want to replace everything that was this thickness and red by blue and this. this other sickness. So you go through replace, and you go through the other values here. And if you want to replace more, you can start again near the find ball and go around here, find, replace, find, replace, find, replace, which is a lot easier, especially with a pen, than if you have to click, 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 as you do on mouse-based interfaces. They also made a scroll bar that was using crossing, so to do an absolute position, you want to go to that position in the scroll bar, you just cross it. If you want page up or page down, you cross it twice quickly. And if you cross the elevator here, then you have direct control over the elevator. So I think that's a nice example of something that uses crossing as the only interaction technique. Yes? Yeah.
It wasn't a good one, and you have to start again across the
10. Certainly, there are some, you know, this was like the first iteration in such a system. Now, one thing I should point out is that you don't have to do the gestures in one stroke. You can lift in the middle and then continue. Now, the example you mentioned that you get to the end and then you want to come back, I would have to get back to the paper to see if this was taken into account. But, you know, it took a long time to refine mouse-based interfaces to solve this kind of problem. So you can't expect the first version of a system like this to to address all these issues. But it's an interesting question. You can find the paper online fairly easily, and I'll put a link to it if you want to see if they give a solution to this. So, to conclude, basic interactions such as pointing are far from optimal, and I think it's an interesting area of research. We are doing research, as you know now, on this big wall that we have, and we have to do all the work on how you point on a wall this size, because we're beyond the limits of Fitts' law. We want to point at a distance as opposed to directly on the screen and things like this. But even on regular interfaces or problem on portable devices also, where you have other issues, so it's still a rich area. And Fitts' law is incredibly robust, so it's nice tool to work with. At a higher level, I think what is important here is to see that all of this relies on information. The information that the system puts out in the display, the part of the information that is on the display that is perceived by the user, and then on the other hand, the information that is produced by the motor system when I do a pointing gesture, and the information from this gesture or from my vision or from past usage that can be captured by the system. And really the only way to improve these techniques is by taking into account all this information and see how additional information that is used by the system can save the user from producing the information. And that will be it for this, and we can take a well-deserved break. Any question? So I didn't have time to show videos, so I'll put pointers to them on the website, and you can watch them.